ceasefire, for an end to the bloodshed, to the carnage. They are proceeding with providing the Israeli regime with more weaponry, feeding weapons into the Israeli war machine against the Palestinian people. Some people have called it Holocaust guilt. What do you make of that?
Germany is famous not just only for the Holocaust between 1935 and 1939 and 1945, but also the first Holocaust of the 20th century when it massacred thousands in Namibia. It seems that either we can say that there is sort of this guilt, or worse, we can actually say that there's something fundamentally wrong with a nation that consistently, over the span of 120 years, has been party to three genocides. And I feel that we should maybe stop giving Germany this sort of free pass by calling it this sort of guilt. If you truly had guilt, then you wouldn't be committing the same crimes over and over again, especially now in real time, when there are things like a case at the ICJ putting forth a ton of evidence of the genocide that then you are going to be party to. I'm not sure we can call it guilt. I actually think that there's something fundamentally wrong with their political makeup and the way in which they are idealizing this particular event.
You make a great point, Sheikh. We're going to stay with the World Economic Forum a bit longer. One of the speakers at the event was Jordanian Prime Minister Bashar al-Hassani, who addressed the South African government's case against the Israeli regime at the International Court of Justice, saying his country would participate if called upon. Let's listen in.
We cannot today, after the lapse of 101 days from this military operation and aggression that Israel has embarked upon in Gaza, we cannot today at all subscribe, as we have from day one, that this is an aggression operation that operates in the context of self-defense, as we all understand it. Self-defense in customary international law is a response to an action that is instant, overwhelming, that needs no choice or means or a moment for deliberation, and that has to be always conditioned by the two requisites of proportionality and necessity. And clearly, in the context of this, of those principles of customary international law that are entrenched in the Caroline case, all of this criteria is not something that's met by the Israeli reaction that has crossed all those boundaries, and that have regrettably probably delved into elements of definitions contained in the Geneva Conventions about war crimes, about crimes against humanity, and even arguably in many instances in cases if intent is shown in the context of actions that could lead to an act of genocide.
I'll put my next question to Carol. And Carol, you heard what the Jordanian official had to say, the prime minister there. Jordan being the country that has seen the impact of displaced Palestinians. There's a sizable population of Palestinian refugees there. How important is it for regional countries to help push the case at the ICJ against Israel in solidarity with the Palestinians?
Well, why haven't they done it? Why is it 105 days? Why wait so long? You know, we've got all... And I was fortunate, I lived in Jordan and I seen... They're under stress. They're under stress. Not only did they take Palestinians, then they took the Syrians, and now they're taking the Palestinians again. And the people of Jordan are getting angry because there's not enough in the pot for everyone. And the other countries need to do their bit, you know. And it's all well and good saying, oh, let's put them here, let's put them there. These are people. This is their home. Palestine is their home. They don't want to leave their home. And the ICJ, they need to be told it has to stop. We have to rebuild Gaza. We have to take the siege off of Gaza. We have to rebuild Palestine and give Palestinians the right to their homeland. All these little sand bites, this, that, and the other, it's not going to work. People need their homes.
No, they voluntary evacuation, which is a euphemism Israelis have been using for ethnic cleansing, basically.
Well, let's send them to Africa, is that the latest one? Why would they want to leave their homes? You know, why have they persevered since 1948? If they had that choice then, they could have went off and made a new life somewhere. Mm-hmm. This is their home. They're not going nowhere. It's where they live. And no matter what the BBC and all these other stations say, like, oh, Israel's got the right to self-defence, Israel's got this, Israel's got that. Israel's not Israel. Israel is Palestine, and people need to recognise that thing, that it's Palestine, and the Palestinians need to be equal. They need to have equal rights, and all this has to stop. And unless the whole community, every community, not only Jordan, not only the help from the poor people of the Yemen, and not only the Lebanese resistance, everybody has to come in. They need to step up. Mm-hmm. And when we've got governments like our own government in Germany who are talking for the people, where the people, you see the millions of people on the streets week after week, day after day, they're not listening to us. They can't keep doing this and allowing these poor Palestinians to suffer in the way they are. Mm.
Sheikh Ladak, is the Israeli regime simply thumbing their nose at international institutions at this point? We've all heard what the Israeli prime minister had to say about the genocide case against Tel Aviv, that it's not going to stop them from continuing with this unfolding genocide.
Let me reverse the question, if I may. When has the Israeli regime not thumbed its nose at international institutions or humanitarian institutions and organizations? If you just go back a second to that question about Jordan and then think about the second question that you've asked, Jordan's military and peacekeeping forces are actually quite significant. Potentially, Jordan can do a lot on the border with Palestine. Its military is some 8.7% of its total GDP. That's not small. It has some 60,000 peacekeeping officers that have been experienced enough to go to places like Angola, Afghanistan, Iraq. So they don't not have experience of how to be able to intervene and give safety to people when needed. So again, we need to ask these fundamental questions like we asked previously. Why are these nations not doing enough? Why are some willing to step up and some unwilling to do anything other than talk at best?
What do you think that is, Sheikh?
We said earlier it's political cowardice. I do feel that the normalization with Israel has become so rampant amongst many of the Arab and Middle East states that so many of them have been put on the back foot that they don't know how to be able to get out of the pit that they've dug for themselves. So because of this has been an ongoing situation for decades now, that it's now so difficult to stop the Israeli regime, which is why you asked that follow-up question. Are they thumbing their nose? Well, when have they not done that? And when have they received any pushback from any significant Middle Eastern nation? So if you've had an experience of being a bully for decades, why would you stop now? What would a case at the ICJ do? What would a meeting at Davos really do? With respect, Israel only understands the language of force, and they've only seen the economic sanctions have done anything to them. At the moment, their international appeal or their PR campaign is so trodden on. They have been exposed by every camera in the world, and still they continue to commit genocide. Last night, just around Nasser Hospital, around Khan Yunus, carpet bombing around another hospital, cutting off telecommunications. They don't listen to logic. They don't listen to anything. Only force and only an international community is going to be able to stop them. And cowardice and being on the back foot is not going to support the Palestinian cause.
The language of force, the language that any occupier seems to understand. This is Gaza Under Attack with me, Saeed Pourza, where we zero in on news of and around the Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. A genocide in 2024 with the entire world watching it live without any serious efforts to stop it defies logic. Two nations who have intervened include Yemen and South Africa. Earlier, we spoke to London-based barrister, activist, and writer Aisha Khan. and asked her if Yemen was breaking any law by targeting vessels in the Red Sea.
Legally, the Americans have absolutely no right to be bombing Yemen. In legal terms, under the UN conventions and resolutions and decisions, and even the Genocide Convention itself, the Rome Treaties, what the legal position actually is that Yemen, as a state, has the duty to, if it sees genocide, to prevent it as it sees fit. So actually, the funny thing, or what we have not seen in the media, is going by the UN's own documents and own judgments and resolutions, Yemen is the only one, by preventing these ships from giving supplies to Israel, the only state acting in accordance with international law. The Yemenis have not killed anyone, have not killed any of their citizens. And we can actually see this in the rhetoric of Joseph Biden and Rishi Sunak. And they're very clear when they speak about why they are taking military action and why it is, and they've said it, is for commercial interests, to keep open commercial shipping lanes and to ensure that commercial ships are not blocked. So they are very clearly saying they are protecting the interests and the private property of the rich and believe that this is a reason to bomb. Obviously, this is not a reason to bomb. It's nothing to do with state security or national security. And at this point, they're just acting as militias for billionaires and for private interests, which is not in their remit at all. And they're acting absolutely illegally.
Aisha urged people from all over the world to write to judges at the ICJ in the South African case against Israel to remind them of the importance of ruling in favor of Palestinian lives and against Tel Aviv's onslaught.
As we are not parties to these proceedings, there is no reason we cannot email the judges to remind them about the evidence, and the evidence obviously of children being having their limbs amputated, disabled children, the mass amount of death in Gaza. And this is simply to remind the judges that they are not state actors, they are jurists, and that their primary concern is the law and is basing their judgments on evidence. This is no different to what Israel actually has done, where they took a diplomatic mission to all of these countries in order for their states to put pressure on these judges to make decisions in the state political interest and not on a legal basis. And we will see this in particular with the American judge, who I absolutely doubt will vote for South Africa's case and will be very heavily swayed by Israel based on the fact that she is under pressure, diplomatic and political pressure, from her own government and from Israel. So if Israel can try and pervert the course of justice, there is no reason why normal human beings, me and you, cannot send evidence to these judges to remind them that they are judges and they are not state actors.
The human cost of the statistics detailing the killed and injured can sometimes be lost in the mire of analysis. An Israeli strike on a house in Rafah has taken the lives of three members of a family sheltering inside. The lament of the distraught father is a tragic reminder that the bombardment of Gaza has left no family unscathed.
When the strike first hit, I woke up screaming, "Massa, Massa," not knowing what had happened. I was unaware of what was going on. I looked around and found that the bombing happened inside my home. Where are my siblings? Where are my children? Thank God, anyway. My daughter has been killed, and my injured brother is in the European hospital, while my second injured daughter is in the Abu Yusuf al-Najjar hospital.
Sheikh Ladak, let's dig deeper a little bit, if we can, on the action taken by South Africa and Yemen in solidarity with Palestinians. What do you make of what they have done? And as far as the South African genocide case against Israel is concerned, what are your hopes and fears in terms of which way the ruling will go?
Between these two great nations, we can see that many of the bases that need covering in this ongoing fight against Israel is being covered. So from one perspective, you have a legal case, you have a diplomatic side. And then from the perspective of Yemen, we have a military campaign and an economic campaign to be able to stop this genocide that's taking place. If you take a step back and try to see what the world is doing, the world is in many cases putting pressure points on all the different areas that it needs to. It's trying to put pressure at the governmental level. There's a media campaign, especially through social media, to try to raise awareness. People are taking to the streets. So there is so much being done to try to pressurize this entity to try to stop what it's doing. What my fears are that many people will put stock in the ICJ case to such an extent that if they decide not to find Israel guilty of its genocide, then people may lose hope of this sort of diplomatic and legal solution. The reality is that no matter what comes from the ICJ, there is no legal reprimand on Israel. Rather, this is the United Nations top court and not actually a court that can actually do anything in terms of a legal reprimand. Yeah. So what I don't want people to do is to lose hope just in case this side of the angle actually doesn't help. What we can see is that by virtue of Britain and America bombing Yemen, it actually shows that this has caused them to intervene to such an extent where they need to directly now intervene in their support for Israel. Can you imagine how much damage Yemen must be doing to the Israeli economy, to the global forces of evil that are carrying out their maniacal practices and behaviors? Otherwise, you wouldn't see them intervening. Now, you can go further with your analysis. The fact that the global media, the Western media, has to hide the truth about what Yemen is doing and not speak about it in its plain context is another evidence of how important Yemen's role is in this conflict. Let me give you an example. If you turn anywhere on BBC News,
if you can, please.
You will only see that they will say that this is in support of Palestine. They won't say that they gave a condition. You are starving the people of Palestine. There's no medicines going through. You have to be able to open up the borders to allow these things through. Then we will stop our advances on the Strait of Mandab. All of this shows how advanced the Yemeni cause has become.
Okay. Carol Swartz, Sheikh Ladak, thank you both for your contributions. And thank you for spending time with us. We'll be back with the latest news and analysis. Until we meet again, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye for now.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله
This is a short part of Imam Khomeini's speech. Those that are now causing destruction for their own nations in that fashion, they do not have feelings. They are devoid of human feelings. This attention to glitter of the material world removes a human being from that feeling of humanity. He is an animal that is walking among the people, trying to strengthen spirituality among this nation. It is with spirituality that you can safeguard your independence and safeguard your freedom and to attain perfection.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. Well, on the subject of unity and fraternity, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh said, I have repeatedly declared that in Islam, things like race, language, nationality, and geography are not topical issues. Muslims, whether Sunni or Shia, are brothers and thus equal and all enjoy all of the Islamic privileges and rights. Well, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh in here is referring to unity between Shia and Sunni Muslims, which is quite essential for the existence of the Muslim world. You know, the principle of la ikraha fid din, no compulsion in matters of faith, that is in Surah Baqarah verse number 256. And it is not just limited to Muslim or non-Muslim relations. It applies to Muslim interpretations of Islam as well. This instruction of God serves as a guideline for the Muslim community not to impose one's interpretation on others. That is why throughout history, Shias and Sunnis brothers too have lived and worked side by side as well. When human beings sit down and talk to each other, they learn to respect each other. Dialogue allows parties to understand each other better by allowing participants to acquire direct knowledge about beliefs instead of relying on propaganda and stereotypical images. Dialogue will isolate the extremist fringe. It is a major sin to kill a human being. Killing a human being is like killing the whole of humanity. By talking to one another, Shias and Sunnis will be able to save lives, which is like saving the whole of humanity. The dialogue between Sunnis and Shias become a movement and a process throughout society instead of anyone waiting for one high-powered dialogue to yield some results at the leadership level. And Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh emphasized this matter because he knew how much the unity between Shia and Sunnis can strengthen the power of Muslim communities. May Allah bless his great soul. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the verses of chapter Nur, the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran, and different commentary points of these verses. Dear listeners, we have reached the 61st verse of the chapter. Now let's listen to this verse.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. ليس على الأعمى حرج ولا على الأعرج حرج ولا على المريض حرج ولا على أنفسكم أن تأكلوا من بيوتكم أو بيوت آبائكم أو بيوت أمهاتكم أو بيوت إخوانكم أو بيوت أخواتكم أو بيوت أعمامكم أو بيوت عماتكم أو بيوت أخوالكم أو بيوت خالاتكم أو ما ملكتم مفاتحه أو صديقكم ليس عليكم جناح أن تأكلوا جميعا أو أشتاتا فإذا دخلتم بيوتا فسلموا على أنفسكم تحية من عند الله مباركة طيبة كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تعقلون.
There is not upon the blind any guilt, nor upon the lame any guilt, nor upon the ill any guilt, nor upon yourselves if you eat from your own houses, or the houses of your fathers, or the houses of your mothers, or the houses of your brothers, or the houses of your sisters, or the houses of your father's brothers, or the houses of your father's sisters, or the houses of your mother's brothers, or the houses of your mother's sisters, or from houses whose keys you possess, or from the house of your friend. There is no blame upon you whether you eat together or separately. But when you enter houses, give greetings of peace upon each other, a greeting from Allah, blessed and good. Thus does Allah make clear to you the verses of ordinance, that you may understand.
So now, dear listeners, we have discussed generally this concepts that are mentioned in this verse. And now we will have a look at what we have said in the last episodes regarding the verse. We said that some believe before Islam, the blind, the sick, and the lame were not allowed to eat food with healthy people. And this verse, the beginning part of this verse, somehow permitted them to eat food in group. And anyway, since the previous verses were about taking permission, this verse discusses more of this subject. And at first it says
that Islam, and after Islam, some people thought that this kind of people must eat lonely, not because they hated eating with them, just because they thought that they are the blind and they cannot see the existing food while they could eat, and they ate. And this is against ethics, so they let them eat alone and lonely. And this matter was presented to the Prophet. The verse was sent down indicating that there is no blame upon the blind or any other kind of sick person that you eat food with together. Now, some others, however, believed that at the advent of Islam, some Muslims avoided eating food lonely, and if they could not find anyone as their company, they would remain hungry. The verse, and this verse of the Holy Quran, taught them that eating lonely is also lawful. There is also another commentary that says that some Arabs believe that as a respect, they should not eat food with their guests because the guest is sometimes feeling uneasy when he is eating in the place where the host is presenting to him or her the food. So this verse was revealed and removed the considerations. Now, we say that this verse could be referring to all of these previous commentary points, and then after that, the verse refer to one ethical matter, and it says that when you enter your houses, you must salute one another. We, regarding this part of the verse, said that the word buyut could mean any other kind of bait or house, and fasallimu ala anfusikum could mean that you should simply salute one another, or it could mean that since you are considered from your family, and family is considered from you, so you are actually considering saluting to yourselves. Or the fact that since you are relationally close to one another, you should sallimu ala anfusikum. Or the fact that since the houses which are empty, even at these cases you should enter and you should actually sallimu ala anfusikum. You should try to salute on yourselves by saying assalamu alayna wa ala ibadillahi s-salihin. And we somehow concluded that there is no inconsistency between all these commentaries, since we have some traditions from Imam Baqir alayhi salam that says, if you enter one house and if you salute the household, they will naturally answer you in return, and they will return the peace and salutation on yourselves. So this is actually the meaning of sallimu ala anfusikum. This means that you are actually saluting on yourselves in the beginning. Now, this was all that we said regarding this verse. على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
أنتم الفقراء
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Now, after discussing the general concepts of the verse, there is one point to be discussed, actually. The point is that, is it true that we do not need to take permission for eating others' food? This is a question. The verse mentioned that Allah has permitted man to eat food from close relatives' houses and some friends' houses and such like. On the whole, these houses are 11 that were mentioned in this verse. And in this verse, taking permission was not mentioned as its condition, and certainly it does not need taking permission, because when permission is taken, we can eat everyone's food and it will not be limited to these 11 houses, naturally. But the point is, and the question is obtaining inward consent necessary as a condition because of intimacy and close acquaintance that is between the two parties? This is an important question. The holy verse apparently rejects this condition too and considers it enough if only he or she is likely consent. We'll discuss this more, God willing, in the next episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry, in your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Aperture. A quarter century after the fall of the Iron Curtain, never have there been so many politically driven walls in our world. Dividing communities, separating the rich from the poor, and marking borders, walls have become the preferred solution for resolving major conflicts. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. This week's documentary explores how the business of constructing barriers is pursued with ever greater physical, financial, and ideological vigor in the 21st century. From the Middle East to the wealthiest societies of the West, municipal, regional, and international walls have become the preferred means of resolving conflicts and addressing or avoiding civil unrest. Stay with us as we investigate the geopolitics of urban and cultural segregation as seen in Iraq, Brazil, and France.
Just imagine that tomorrow we were to live in private villages behind high security fences. The Mirail neighborhood in Toulouse. 35,000 people live here. From the outside, it's considered a volatile ghetto. The Mirail is dogged by high unemployment and boredom. At night, as a distraction, youngsters noisily rev their engines. This is a public area. Only one association is trying to maintain some sort of law and order, a local group called the Mediators.
Don't hang about here, right under the buildings. Go home. Look at the time. People are asleep now.
Okay, we'll go. Actually, until the Mediators tell us to go home, we hang around outside. Do the residents ever call the police to say they can't stand the bloody noise anymore? Yeah, it can happen. It happens often.
They
call the police, yeah, sure. We know that because they see that the police won't intervene, so they ask us to help. We get involved, but as you saw, they're on public property, and we can talk to them. Tell them to put their motorbikes away. If they listen, all the better. The police never come here for that sort of thing. Well, if they do, it would be a game of cat and mouse, you know what I mean? In this kind of social housing, they now take care of their own security. They've learned to live without the police. That doesn't bother you? No, it's okay. I've never been scared. She's been here since 1975. No, and sometimes I go out. I come back at 4 or 5 in the morning. Used to come home and I never had any problems. That means there's a... What about the police? Do they ever come here when you call them? The police? I don't know. I really don't know. But I think it would be worse if they did come. Zubir Sadi was born here, grew up here, and has witnessed the neighborhood slowly change. They've only just got their license as well. I've looked after him for a while now. All he did was stupid things. I saw the mix of people who used to live here. There were whites, Europeans, all sorts of backgrounds. I used to see my parents, they'd go and visit the neighbours. All sorts of different mixes of people. But slowly people began to leave. And we were lucky, because we experienced that kind of diversity. These youngsters don't know that. I was scared, to be honest. There was always so much noise. I saw cars set on fire. But unfortunately, the police would never come, because they'd get attacked. So you felt the estate was left to fend for itself? Yeah, that's right. We'll turn over here. Paulette is one of the middle-class residents that has fled the social housing estates. There, that's it. That last building down there. I used to live there, up on the 6th floor. Do you ever come back?
No.
No. I never wanted to come back. And I never have. Why not? I don't feel comfortable. You see, where I live now, there are just 2 floors. Here, there can be as many as 15 floors. It's like cages for hens. Paulette moved to a nearby protected estate. There are more of them in Toulouse than anywhere else in France. She now feels much better. We all know each other. We're safe. We can leave the door open. No one can come in. There are no problems. We're not scared of anything. Here we go, this way. Enclosed residences are not necessarily ghettos for the rich. Paulette is a civil servant. That's nice, isn't it? She has a modest salary and a 45 square meter apartment like all those who live here. With her neighbours, Paulette has rediscovered some of the warmth of the poorer areas. I've got just about everybody's spare set of keys, because some of my neighbours are a bit scatty, so you never know. It's very friendly here in this residence. I think it's very pleasant to be here. We're not far from town, and it's a bit like being in the countryside. It's quiet, you can walk around, and there's a pool. It's like a holiday camp. But here, the rules are strict. Even too strict, says Christine, a resident. They've been sending out non-stop things, you know, like notices telling people how to behave, not to make too much noise. I think it's... Well, yeah, the rules are a bit strict sometimes. I mean, to ask children not to shout outside when they need to shout. Kids shout. If I hear a kid laughing, I don't think it's a nuisance. That's all. You know, I'm fairly moderate. I don't know. I think it's a bit much. Well, it's not the kids for me, it's the adults. The ones who don't show respect for others, to be honest. There was one person here who wasn't very nice. He made a lot of mistakes. Well, he made noise once or twice. No, he was noisy. I mean, I couldn't sleep once.
trees.
But my neighbor's camera picked him up. In this small paradise, if you make too much noise, the various security devices will hear you. We're undergoing an urban segregation in this country. Some have recently suggested using the term fragmentation to describe this new kind of town, made up of separate parts that have increasingly less in common with each other. So it really marks the end of a kind of society. Yes, it could well be the end of a certain type of society, or in fact a new multi-speed society, a club society, in which the public good is considered like a club. If you can afford it, you pay for membership of the club and benefit from the goods. If you can't, you won't have them. Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, where the economy is booming. The country, though, is cut into two. The middle classes have flocked into enclosed areas, condominiums, entire sectors behind high railings and armed guards. Brazil is copying Florida with its gated communities, enclosed villages. Right next to the condominiums are the world's largest slums. Two nations, that of the rich and the poor, who live on either side of the ramparts. Thais and her mother always lived in the so-called condominios. Well, the idea for condominios came from keeping people closed off, but with hobbies and things to do on the inside. There's a bar where you can meet your friends. It's also to be close to each other without needing to go out or risk being attacked. Why? Because the streets are considered dangerous? Yes, yeah, especially at night. And you can't be at the mercy of other people in the streets. Unfortunately, that's today's reality. So they found the way to mix safety with hobbies and pastimes. It's like being outside. In fact, a whole generation is growing up inside the condominiums that will never get to know the real Brazil. It's true. I really think we've created gilded cages. We're prisoners of luxury. I really wish my children were as lucky as I was. I grew up in an apartment block, but we used to play out in the streets. I had that freedom. Today, if I go past the same area where I grew up, I see it's no longer possible. Everyone's a bit more enclosed nowadays. Right alongside the condominiums are the favelas. It's the Brazil of the workers and cleaning women, as well as armed teenagers who live off the drugs trade. They form an alternative kind of justice in these forgotten slums. Shaolin has been in charge of the residents' association for a long time. To him, segregation is the worst form of violence. More than the physical wall that separates us, there's the invisible social wall, which is far more hurtful. The superior classes in their buildings, and we, people of no class, in our huts. Right next to each other. The city has to integrate, otherwise there'll be chaos. Directly opposite the huge favela Rocinha on the São Conrado beach are some of the most expensive housing estates in Brazil. They're not just criminals up there. There are some better people up there than they are down here. More honest people. One day, Augusto witnessed a shootout between cocaine traffickers and military police. A scene from a war film. And there was a problem fairly recently between the guys from the Vidigal favela and those from Rocinha. They encountered the military police and there was a fight. They ran off, and in the confusion, they crossed in, went out the other side. That's it. They caused no trouble. They just crossed through.
essas grades também.
You know, the wall, it's not real security. There are 500,000, 400,000 of them, and just 10,000 of us. If they come down, nothing will stop them. On the other side of the railings, the government decided to seize control of the favelas. In November 2010, the army and its armored cars are called in. 4 days of fighting in the north zone eventually forces the traffickers out. The government troops hoist the national colors, a symbol of the victory of one nation over another. Today, Captain Felipe Barreto and his men are on patrol to prevent the gangs from returning. I don't know any city like Rio, with the rich right next to the poor, literally wall to wall. The social impact is very negative. You see down there, where the car is? Before, the police wouldn't have been able to go there. 20 meters away, they'd shoot at you. Just one cop on the corner and they'd open fire. So that was the border? Yeah, that was the border. And what about the other public services? Can they come in? Firemen, postmen, doctors? Well, before, it was only with the permission of the traffickers, so it was a parallel government. Exactly, the media used to call it parallel powers. Are they less now? Oh, yeah, many were killed. And they fled as well, right? Yeah, all were arrested. Others moved to Rocinha. Rocinha is home to countless thousands of poor. Among them, some heavily armed young men. The traffickers tolerated our presence on their territory so long as we never filmed them. And we were given escorts. One longtime member of the drug world does, however, agree to be interviewed. Nowadays, Regis has stopped dealing. He's settled down, has a family and work, and tries to lead a dignified life. Like most dealers, Regis was also an addict. I took a lot of drugs for 10 years. From the ages of 15 to 26, I hit rock bottom. A lot of cocaine, alcohol. Oh, it lasted for 10 years. I lost my friends, traffickers, thieves. I used to live among all of that. They call me the last of the Mohicans. Why? Because the rest of my generation are all dead. For many of the favela's youngsters, drugs remains the easiest career move. With the intoxicating feeling the street belongs to you. They are arrogant and well-armed, but few will live to see 30. They will be killed by the police or rival gangs. People used to look at me differently. They'd look away when they saw me. My own mother didn't trust me anymore. But thanks to God, I was able to get out of it. Now I have my daughter, my wife, my house and my work. It must be a struggle. Yeah, it is a struggle. But the most important thing is to have abandoned the drug scene. The favelas issue is about successive governments having basically abandoned them. It's just government negligence. That's why we're in the state we're in today. After having assaulted the area, the police tries to do some social work. A community police unit has set up in the middle of the favela, its aim to stop the drug gangs returning. We arrive, we set up, and then we determine what the needs are, and we try and get back into the areas that have been abandoned by the state. Yeah, by the state and by society in general. Captain Barreto's men have established an advance base at the top of the favela.
It's a strategic position with a bird's eye view over the condominiums. And Baghdad, the city of 1,000 walls. After 8 years of war, a fragile peace exists behind concrete ramparts. The walls crisscross the city over hundreds of kilometers, causing never-ending detours. Abu Hazem is a taxi driver in the Daura district, which was controlled by insurgents back in 2007. I have to go around the wall, go to the end of the motorway, and come all the way back. It's like a huge prison. It's bad for morale, too. Does the wall make it safer? Does it bring work? Well, in fact, the wall has made it safer. Before, no one could pass here. It was too dangerous. Between 2003 and 2007, Iraq was ravaged by an incredibly vicious civil war. U.S. soldiers were constantly targeted. Certain areas were completely controlled by the insurgents. Then the Shiite and Sunni militias began killing each other. According to The Lancet, a respected medical journal, 600,000 civilians were killed. That's when the Americans conceived of the idea of building walls around the most violent areas. They would contain the insurrection and separate the Sunnis from the Shiites. Baghdad would resemble Berlin during the time of the wall. The U.S. Army spokesman, however, confirms they are also building gated housing, like the retired people's homes in California.
We're building different walls all throughout the city here, different communities, and you've heard the concept of gated communities.
Mm-hmm. Funny, a gated community, to me, just connotes, you know, an exclusive sort of Coral Gables, Florida kind of setup, which is not what you mean, is it?
The gated communities are designed to protect the population in selected neighborhoods throughout Baghdad.
Many of them don't like it at all. They feel that it will further divide the city on sectarian lines.
Well, the intent is not to divide the city on sectarian lines. Once again, the intent is to provide a more secure neighborhood for the people that live in selected neighborhoods. And if we find areas that we think that the gated communities will do good and will control the population, we'll probably build more.
Each zone is surrounded by a wall. It's like living on a reserve. We're stuck inside. And the wall was the Americans' idea. It was American material and vehicles that were used to build it. There never was the split between Sunnis and Shiites before the Americans arrived. Sunnis, Shiites, Christians and Jews, we were all Iraqis first. And the first thing the Americans ask you now is, are you Shiite or Sunni?
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very interesting question, and that question is about what are the consequences of a polytheist acts of good? As you know, in this world, you know, Muslims are of the belief, we're of the belief that, you know, if somebody doesn't believe in Islam, if somebody's not a Muslim, he doesn't believe in Islam, he doesn't adhere to Islam, then, you know, his ultimate destination in the hereafter is the hellfire, right? Is that he's going to go to hell. So a question arises, and that is this, that we see that a lot of people who aren't Muslims, regardless of whether they are, you know, the adherents of Abrahamic religion,